The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, Indie Media Mixes, a collection of mixes of music and voice from across the Indie Media Network. But first, these headlines.
IndieMedia.org reports that Irish anti-war activist Mary Kelly won a non-conviction for the charge of criminal damage to a U.S. naval aircraft that had landed at Shannon Airport in Ireland for refueling. The jury found her guilty on the much less serious charge of trespass, with the judge adjourning sentencing until October. The jury could not come to a 10-2 majority to convict her for the damage to the aircraft.
The following story was reported on the Washington, D.C. IMC website. On July 7th, activists from various local groups came together at noon to demand that the city reopen the much-needed Franklin School building as a shelter for homeless people in the McPherson Square area in Washington, D.C. This rally was the first of a series of weekly vigils outside City Hall, which will continue as long as the ex-shelter stands empty. Though the number of activists present today was small, the spirit was strong, and each bore a handmade sign creatively explaining the housing crisis in the district. One sign read, quote, "McMayor and McCouncil seen serving McHypothermia sandwiches to the homeless," unquote. An allusion to the city taking action to close the shelter as a result of a complaint against it filed by McDonald's. The colorful banner simply read, quote, "Save the Franklin Shelter," unquote, and turned the heads of many a politico on their lunch break. The demonstration was non-confrontational, save for one police officer, who took it upon himself to physically stop activists from writing with chalk on the public sidewalk. Since sidewalk chalking is not illegal, of course, no arrests were made. Overall, an effective start to a campaign which will hopefully draw more attention over the next few weeks.
The following headline was taken from the Washington, D.C. IMC. A number of organizations, including Africa Action, Trans Africa Forum, Foreign Policy in Focus, and 50 Years is Enough Network, held a press briefing in the days before the president left for his African tour. Salih Booker from Africa Action noted that Bush has made much of his commitment to fighting AIDS in Africa, but the president requested no new money this year, and only $450 million in new money for 2004. One of the single most pressing issues to the people of Africa will not be addressed on his tour, Africa's debilitating foreign debts. Mara Vanderslice of Jubilee USA Network said that countries in sub-Saharan Africa pay out about $14.5 billion every year in debt service. This is more than the continent receives in foreign aid, around $12 billion, and more than is needed to stem the tide of AIDS, estimated at $10 billion annually.
That wraps up headlines. Thanks to Kevin Heinrich for collecting them and to Beth Rockenbach, as well as Kevin, for reading them. This week's show is a collage of indie media, DIY, and pirate radio projects. There is a wealth of thought-provoking sound out there, and in this half hour we'll hear from Freak Radio Santa Cruz, Axis of Evil, and Inhibi Combatant Radio, to name a few. Here we go.
It's the 420 Drug War News. My friends, this drug war is dead. There is no heartbeat, and there is no brain function left. On Wednesday, July 9th, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee considered the Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP, Reauthorization Act of 2003. The Democrats on the committee didn't rubber stamp the bill. Instead, they used the hearing as an opportunity to attack not only the Bush administration's medical marijuana policy, but also the war on drugs in its entirety. U.S. Representative Gerald Nadler, New York, pressed the medical marijuana issue. He proposed an amendment that would have ended the drug czar's practice of interfering in states' efforts to pass medical marijuana legislation. Then he proposed another amendment that would have prevented the drug czar from approving the budget of any agency that used funds to arrest medical marijuana patients. All Democrats in attendance supported this amendment. More surprising was the strength with which the Democrats denounced a war on drugs. The spark that lit the fuse for this explosion was an amendment proposed by U.S. Rep. Maxine Waters, Democrat out of California, who would have deleted the entire reauthorization bill, saying, quote, "The bill was not worth the paper it's printed on." Waters declared that ONDCP is, quote, "wasteful, ineffective, and unworthy," end quote. U.S. Representative Melvin Watt, Democrat of North Carolina, called the war on drugs a, quote, "dismal failure," and said that there is nothing he is more embarrassed about than the federal government's drug policy. Nadler and U.S. Rep. Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat out of Texas, also had harsh words for the war on drugs, while the committee's ranking member, U.S. Rep. John Conyers, Democrat out of Missouri, decried the growing number of prisoners in this country serving time for nonviolent drug offenses. In the end, 10 of 11 Democrats in attendance voted in favor of deleting the entire bill. You can almost feel the once seemingly impenetrable wall of the war on drugs starting to crumble. That message brought to us by the Marijuana Policy Project.
Bed in this little shack kind of thing, and one of the guys in the group, he was an editor from back east, and he wakes up, and it was really hot and stifling, so he goes outside. It's still dark out, sun hasn't come up yet. And he's sitting on the front steps of the shack, and he feels like somebody's watching him. And he turns around, there's these two little Haitian kids. So he beckons to them, you know. Not talking, but he's got a notebook and he's drawing pictures and they're doing hand signals. Kids say something to each other, and they nod and smile, and they grab them by the hand, and they say, you know, come on, we're going to take you somewhere, and they start dragging them off down this path into the woods. And the guy gets a little bit worried, you know, like, where the hell are these kids taking me? And they take them up the path, they're going up the side of this hill. And the guy, he was very honest, he was a white guy, and he said all this racism that he wasn't even aware it was in him, started to come out like, oh my God, they're going to take me and put me in a big pot. This racism. Going up the side of this hill, up this path, and this guy is starting to freak out. This guy is starting to freak out. And he says, just as he's like so scared that he's about to break away from him, the kids stop, and they turn him around, and they face him east. And the sun was just breaking the horizon at the end of that valley, and all the shafts of sunlight were shafting into the trees, and all the songbirds were coming to song. And he said it was the most beautiful experience of his entire life. And he looked down, and these two little kids were looking up at him with these huge smiles on their face because they knew what they just gave him. These kids didn't have shoes. They didn't have real pants. They had rags on. They had no material wealth, and they reached out across the entire class structure of the planet to a guy from the top of the pyramid, from their position at the bottom, and they touched his heart in a way that changed his life forever. That guy will never be the same. When he told us the story, we all cried, right? Now, if those little kids who are not literate and have no material resources can do that, we can change the world. We can end hunger, we can end war, we can end environmental destruction. It's not as hard as it sounds. We can change things.
Colin, what do you think about being at this peace demonstration with your dad?
What's going on?
I think it's good.
Do you think it's good what your dad's doing?
Mm-hmm. I think it's very, 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 very good.
That he's working for peace?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about George W. Bush?
That's sort of bad things. He's doing like drop bomb, people die. And that's not good.
And how old are you?
5.
Do your friends talk about that?
No.
You're the only one?
Mm-hmm. The only one that thinks about it.
Does your dad talk about that a lot?
Dad does talk about it a lot.
What makes you hear about it on the radio every day?
Democracy Now!
So you like Amy Goodman?
Like Amy Goodman.
Did you listen to Democracy Now! Today?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to say anything to Amy Goodman?
Amy Goodman is a good person.
Have you ever met Amy Goodman?
Dad showed me pictures of Amy Goodman.
We listen on the computer, so he sees the webpage when I go to find that day's show. Because we're in Austin, so we don't have it here. We wish we did.
It was nice meeting you, Colin.
Mm-hmm.
Fight the power.
In order to fight the power.
Right on. Fight the power.
Fight the power.
The revolution will not be televised, but it will be broadcast.
What we got to say?
Yeah.
Fight the power.
Fight the power.
What we got to say?
The only one will push
fight the power. Come on. What we got to say? Fight the power.
Yeah.
The only one that thinks about it.
We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization.
They keep on bombarding this area in front of us. Have they not finished with all these? Look, if they want to bombard the palaces, are they not our heritage? Because it is decreed, because it's the birthplace of our president, they went and bombarded one of the best museums in the country. Do you know that? Do you know they have attacked our university, which is called Muslim Sadia? Do you know they have attacked one of the oldest schools in the whole world, called Muslim Sadia School? Do you know that? Well, please tell your people. Let them have a respect for human heritage. This is not Iraq's heritage only. It belongs to the whole world.
To the Iraqi people, let me say that the day of your liberation will soon be at hand.
Do you think we believe that you come to free us? Why can't you be either human or logical? You are neither human nor logical in this act. And I was surprised and shocked to hear people applauding your president this evening for the nonsense he was saying. Everybody knows it.
However long it takes to win, however long it takes to achieve our objective, that's important for you to know, the American people to know, our allies to know, and the Iraqi people to know. However long it takes.
You should hear today the people who were bombarded in a very local, modest area where people go and have their fruits because we eat. Don't think we are hungry people. We have fresh fruit every day. We have fresh vegetables every day. People were going to shop and there were 2 rockets on that area. Why? Why? What for?
We're working together to make the world more peaceful. We're working together to make our respective nations and all the free nations of the world more secure. And we're working to free the Iraqi people.
And you tell me you are not for oil? What are you for then? Killing people? Just killing people like that?
I often try to put myself in other people's shoes and ask myself, in this case, for example, an Iraqi citizen, what they have to be seeing is
a good deal of evidence that the Iraqi people want to be liberated.
Democracy doesn't come by rockets. Democracy comes by dialogue. Why do you want us to listen to your rockets? You talk about peace. You talk about having no interest in Iraq, but to free Iraq. How could you free Iraq with your rockets and your bombardment?
I am not what you think I am. Start with a border town in Mazatlan. Add 4 pounds of parental dependence, a cup of hope, a quart of want for a better life. Stir in a giant fence, about 1,000 border guards, a missing of a green card. Mix all ingredients together in one large vegetable field in southern Cali, and chill at 32 degrees early in the morning until late in the afternoon. Me llamo Ednareli Chávez, y soy la hija de dos lenguas, dos culturas, y de dos sistemas que me opriman. No soy solamente red, white, and blue, pero red, green, yellow, and true. My name has too many letters and rolled R's for the teacher to pronounce even an ounce of my fame, so I wait patiently till my name gets called. And then the massacre will begin, and I will say it's okay and to call me Elizabeth, because it sounds more nice in American. Eso lugar, en estas tierras nuevas me intimidan. I'm not sure where I fit in, where all my pride, where all my language and my days of work have amounted to. I am castigated for my small brown body sweating under the sun while the prophets rip the pages out of my empty notebooks. And on the days I do get to fill those empty pages, I find my head hurts and nobody will pay attention to me. Fase partida de gente pobre, de gente desesperados por nuestra situación en las escuelas. Restless thoughts sitting in the school chair and desk, thinking I'm dumb when I'm not, all my potentials twisted in knots. And when the teacher tries to tame my wild tongue and warns me that it should be ripped out of my mouth for fear of contaminating the classroom with mis malas palabras, palabras de los indígenas. So inside the locked file cabinets and under the piles of dusty report cards, my Spanish gets erased and replaced, so I move to another place in the classroom. What the hell am I doing here? I am their linguistic nightmare. I am too much mezclaje of the underclass and working class, a confused identity, an outspoken presentation of resistance to the 35-hour weeks, 5 days a week and 9 months a year. One size fits all. That which is not accepted gets bussed down the hall. So I'm rooted in my attitude and my poise to close shop of the helping hands of the afternoon mentors. So I take the 14 mission. I walk through La Zona, over the leftover piles of drunkenness and joblessness, whiffs of a day-old reality following me up the block, and into my home, a different world than the one I left behind. This is where I live. This is where I am, Ednareli. The inner city projects, the barrios, the ghettos, the dwellings left dormant. And somehow coming up inside of this, enduring sometimes what life has worse to offer. So I hate my skin because in this tight-knit cultural radius I call life, I am all that I see. Images reminding me of my brown skin. It's brown skin, olive skin, silky skin, golden skin.
Asa Hutchinson.
I consider debating drug policy or discussing drug policy a significant challenge, but also an opportunity to articulate the facts that are important in developing policy that's going to shape our future and impact so greatly the next generation.
The only difference from 1920 and now is they can't take us out and hang us on a tree. They can just send us to prison for life. It's the same thing. We ain't gonna never be free again. We all gonna die.
In the last two decades, the war on drugs has become a principal excuse for locking up tons and tons of black and brown people. They call that racial profiling, and they do that everywhere, everywhere. So why is it you got so many black folks getting locked up? Because we're the only ones they're looking for.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. My name is Howard Wooldridge. I'm a retired police officer from Bath Township, Michigan. And simply put, as another voice in law enforcement, as a colleague of mine once said, in terms of enforcement, in terms of stopping vehicles, it's two blacks, two browns, two yellows, or I don't stop the car. Why bother? Of course, to use racial slurs. But that, in a nutshell, tells you where law enforcement is coming from and why there is this incredible disparity between who's arrested and who is not.
In the spring of 1998, Sheriff Larry Stort decided to investigate the drug scene in Tulia, a small town in the Texas Panhandle. Using funds from a regional drug task force, the sheriff hired an undercover agent named Tom Coleman to conduct a covert sting operation.
The Honorable Asa Hutchinson.
And it is important because it impacts in such an incredible way our family, our neighbors, and our communities. We are all touched in a very personal way by the impact of drugs.
In 18 months, Coleman had allegedly made more than 100 controlled buys of powdered cocaine. As the images of suspects appeared on the evening news, it was clear that those caught in the sting had something in common. 39 of the 46 arrested came from Tulia's tiny black community, which numbers less than 350. More than 10% of the town's black population had been taken down on the word of one man.
7 in the morning. Honest to goodness, by 12:01.
In a very personal way.
They came with eviction notices. I mean, there was 13 women.
Our neighbors.
In the cell together.
Our family.
And we all received these eviction notices at the same time. If that's not conspiracy for something, then what is?
We are all touched.
We hadn't even been completely booked in. We hadn't even got our bond, you know, sentencing or anything before we got eviction notices.
Our neighbors.
And, you know, we were thinking, the ladies that were locked up, you know, they had children. What were they going to do? How were they going to get their stuff moved out of the house and everything?
Our family.
I mean, it was just one hard day that day. I mean, everything was taken away in one swoop.
In our communities.
Not one of the raids turned up drugs, weapons, or significant amounts of cash.
If there are that many drug dealers here, I just wondered why I couldn't ever borrow any money from anybody. I mean, no one had any money. Nobody had bank accounts. Nobody owned a home. Nobody owned a car. Cars were repossessed. And I mean, nobody owned anything, you know? And for them to say that was many drug dealers here, and for Tom Coleman to spend as much money as he had here, you know, you'd think they'd have found some of that money, you know? Or found some of the merchandise that was bought with that money. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing.
Gary Gardner, a farmer who lives in nearby Vigo Park, became an advocate for the defendants.
I initially got into it because of a lot of the statements that I thought were prejudicial. Plus, the way that they drug these people in front of the cameras. I guarantee you, if you drug my wife in front of the camera at daylight without letting her comb her hair, she's going to come across not a pretty person, although she's one of the prettiest women I know. And they had facilities up there to protect the dignity of these people. They have a garage up there to jail they could have drove these cars in and unloaded these prisoners and booked them without doing that embarrassing number. So they had to have done that deliberately. And the only reason I could think of to do it was to influence the people in town that these people were guilty. I don't consider anyone I'm convicted yet. I don't care if they have had 11, 10, 15 trials, because they haven't had a fair trial in front of an impartial group of their peers. And until they do, in my books, they're not convicted. They're just being held illegally.
More than half of the defendants pled not guilty and went to trial. Many were sent to prison, their sentences ranging from 20 to more than 300 years.
But I told myself, if you didn't do it, you know, we were just saying, oh, you're going to be okay. Your retrial, you'll get out of this.
As well, I said, you didn't do it, did you? He told me no. I said, well, if you didn't do the crime, then you stand to be right. And that's why Freddie didn't take a plea bargain. That's why he went to trial.
Joe Moore, the first defendant tried, was described by District Attorney Terry McEachern as one of Tullia's major drug dealers. At 67 years old, Joe Moore, a hog farmer, was the oldest defendant. He was sentenced to 99 years for 2 counts of cocaine delivery.
He was made out to be the horriblest, baddest person, you know, in the world. The kingpin, the top man of whatever.
He never owned any expensive vehicles, any expensive toys, or any expensive house. If he ever made any money dealing dope, he still got it, because he damn sure didn't spend it.
In Joe Moore's case, it was used as an example to the rest of the blacks. You plead or you go down for life.
That's mainly why I took the plea bargain. I was scared. I wanted to see my family. I had seen how much time they gave other people. I figured they'd do the same to me, which they would. I ain't no different from them. We all black.
It really haven't changed because they was doing this when I was a little girl. I remember when we had to go through the back door to get hamburgers or whatever, you know. I remember all that stuff. So I guess it's trying to get back like that. I don't know what
it
is.
Why do we have federal money for undercover? We have an undercover in here all the time. Trying to, basically, the way I seduce young people. Mm-hmm. That's their job, is seduction. Anyway, I'm afraid for my children, and I'm afraid for everyone's children because of this mindset of catching people, of catching them and punishing them. It's frightening and it's wrong.
Asa Hutchinson.
And it is important because it impacts in such an incredible way our family, our neighbors, and our communities. We are all touched in a very personal way.
The main reason I pled out is because if I wouldn't have, I know I was probably going to do get at least 25 max. I mean, nothing less. And the second reason I pled out is because my friend Michelle Williams, she had gone like a week prior to that and got sentenced, you know, and her kids were here. And I had someone to take care of my kids if I were to go, but who was going to take care of hers?
Our nation's future.
I just didn't want to leave them, you know, hanging out there to dry.
Our family.
So that's one of the reasons I took the plea. It's for the kids.
Our neighbors.
And the kids, they just cry and cry. You know, they wake up at night, they want their mama, and they cry and cry and cry.
We are all touched in a very personal way.
And sometimes I'm here, but I'm crying.
Our family.
So, you know, it's pretty rough.
Our neighbors.
And it's not only me. I think a lot of the families,
family.
They just, when they by themselves, they probably just cry, and they just wonder, you know,
our neighbors,
why this happened like
that. And our communities.
It's no future for them here, the young black people. You are wonderful as long as you're winning our football games, our basketball game.
The Honorable Asa Hutchinson.
In Arkansas, we love football, specifically Razorback football. And I remember a game that is of epic proportions in Arkansas. And if memory serves me well, we ultimately punted on third down in a key situation.
We come together on sports.
And so what does this have to do with drug policy?
Now, that's about the only thing that I've seen that can bring two of you together.
And as a result, the Razorbacks lost that game 7-0.
Like, most of the boys that they got were athletes, and now in high school.
Well, I believe that there are some folks that would like to punt on third down.
And yeah. They're junior high, and now they're arresting them.
Not giving us a chance to move to fourth down.
But as long as they was on the football team winning their game, they would not
and actually make a first down.
Run and they race, run, boy, run.
And have success in this effort.
They wouldn't have cared. But now when they graduated, oh, we ain't going to worry about them no more. We can't help them no
that,
more.
Punting on third down should reflect the true perspective.
Talking about a young individual who graduates that happens to be black
If that individual is a star athlete,
The true perspective on our efforts and the progress that we've made.
For some reason, that individual ends up in prison here. They graduate from high school, they get their PhD in the prison. Prison house diploma.
And the progress that we've made.
Run, boy, run! Run!
Don't throw away the kids.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. The coordination of this show is funded by the Funding Exchange's Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. If you'd like to get involved with this show, drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. No experience is necessary. Archives of this program are available at the IMC website, www.ucimc.org. You can also stop by a week from today at 6 p.m. at the IMC for our monthly meeting. Take care and see you next week.